can guarantee their lives and property. That means the party state can win only by making the people feel that our Communist Party is their only hope in a major crisis, that the party state is the only power great enough to concentrate our resources to do big things. Now, you're talking about having a government or having anarchy, little C needled He Dongshen. Nobody said that the government has to be your Communist Party. It's fruitless to argue that, said He Dongshen. The government and the party are one and the same. After you created a state of anarchy, asked little C, and fooled everyone so that even the people of Beijing filled the streets to welcome the People's Liberation Army into the city, what did you want to do then? Why did you have to have a crackdown? Do you know how many people die every time there's a crackdown? I was almost executed in that crackdown, said Fang Chaodi. In good faith, I also hope that this was our last crackdown, said He Dongshen. But the government in power at the time had no other choice but to take a hard line in the face of the upcoming transfer of power. With the global economy in the deep freeze, China had to save itself. That required administering strong medicine to the economy, but the government might lose control of society, its orders might be distorted, and the people might protest. The government had to have complete control over society and tame the masses. Everybody had to be submissive to government orders. But how does the Chinese government usually tame the masses? In 1983, when the market economy experienced turmoil, didn't old Deng order a crackdown? And the 4th of June 1989 was another big crackdown. Do you see? Sacrifices are inevitable if we want to accomplish something big and important. Little Xi and Fang Chaodi felt He Dongshen was being unreasonable, and they were anxious to refute his arguments, but he motioned for them to let him finish first. In 1816, the year after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, He Dongshen went on, the effects of the war faded and Britain suffered an economic recession. Its national debt was 2.5 times its GDP. Most unfortunately, in 1815, the Mount Tambora volcano in Indonesia erupted, the worst eruption in history, and spread volcanic ash all around the world. The next year was called the Year Without a Summer, and there was virtually no agricultural harvest in Europe. The British Prime Minister at the time was Lord Liverpool. And who do you think his advisor was? None other than the celebrated economist David Ricardo. In the face of an imminent economic depression, potentially leading to great social unrest, they instituted a program of crisis management. And what was it? Liverpool got Parliament to agree to a suspension of habeas corpus, Britain's protection of personal freedom. The government could round up and imprison anyone who caused trouble or didn't do what they were told, without following the law or legal procedures. In modern language, the government could trample human rights at will. The result of this policy was that during the entire period of economic decline, the usual troublemakers didn't dare start anything, and in 1 year, the national economy recovered. Wasn't that pretty amazing? Little C and Fang Chaodi sat grimly with their arms folded. Of course, the people were going to suffer and be hungry during this crisis, and besides, such recessions have always been a cyclical phenomenon of capitalism in the past. They would last a year or two, and after getting through them, everything would return to normal. But this latest crisis was like the Great Depression of the 1930s, and it might have lasted for a decade or more. The government couldn't just ride it out. They had to go into action. My main point is that stability is always the number one priority, but stability is not the ultimate goal. We need stability in order to accomplish great things. Therefore, in extraordinary times or emergency situations, we have to order a crackdown. We have to beat the grass to frighten the tigers. After that, while the effects of the crackdown are still in play, we are free to implement new policies. The Chinese model. According to He Dongshen, the crackdown was the second phase of the action plan for achieving prosperity amid crisis. The third phase was to put forth a set of 5 new policies. Number one, 25% of the balance of every national bank savings account was to be converted into vouchers for use in China only. One-third of these had to be spent within 90 days and two-thirds within 6 months. Beyond that time limit, they would no longer be valid. The Chinese people's excessive savings were one of the reasons for insufficient domestic demand. Personal savings equaled more than 20% of the nation's annual GDP, and business savings were more than 30%. When the foreign economic environment was bad, people with surplus cash held on to their money and spent even less. With everyone doing this, how could the economy avoid recession? Merely lowering bank interest rates and moral suasion were no longer enough to make the Chinese people spend their money. The government had to rely on coercive measures of the sort Western countries would not dare dream of. The greatest thing about this government order was that it was so simple to enforce. All the banks are computerized, so it was easy to cut into the savings accounts. The second virtue of this policy was that it only affected people who had money. It primarily impacted on the urban middle or moderately well-off classes who had got rich quick in the reform era. These included civil servants, professionals, white-collar workers, staff in government enterprises, small business entrepreneurs and pensioners. The government could easily get away with making them spend 25% of their savings on themselves in order to stimulate the national economy and help China make it through the crisis. Consumers and businesses all started spending money. The third benefit of this policy was that it did not need the national treasury to allocate major funds or follow Keynesian job creation to turn the recession around. At the very least, it would successfully jump-start the engine of an economic growth driven by domestic demand. This policy was estimated to have increased the GDP by at least 5 percentage points. The urban population with savings was busy trying to decide where to spend the vouchers and on what commodities or services. Number two. Since demand had been created, it had to be supplied. The second set of new policies was to repeal over 3,000 regulations governing the manufacturing and service sectors, making it easier for private capital to invest in business, relaxing credit policies for companies catering to domestic demand, and encouraging entrepreneurship. At the same time, the function of government was transformed in accordance with the slogan, "The officials retreat and the people move in." The government removed the restrictions on all businesses except those involving national security and government monopolies. "Now anyone can start a publishing company," said He Dongshan, looking straight at Old Chen. "You can just publish your books without a government-issued book number." "But all books still have to be sent in for approval," countered Old Chen, "and many subjects are still forbidden." "But at least today there are private publishers everywhere," said He Dongshan. "There are even Chinese and foreign joint venture publishing companies, all in complete accord with WTO requirements." These policies were extremely effective. In a short time, it looked like everyone in China was in business. Everybody was talking business, regardless of age, sex, location or trade. Everybody was trying to make money, looking for talented employees or being sought out themselves, searching for raw materials or for people to buy or sell some resource. The Chinese people, you know, just give them a chance to do something and they can make a great success of it. It was almost a miracle how quickly Guangdong, Jiangsu and Zhejiang's underused industrial capacity was changed over from manufacture for export to production for the domestic market. New products and new services flooded the market in the space of a couple of months. In 6 months, China successfully transformed itself from an economy dependent on investment and exports to one driven by domestic demand. "How successful were these policies?" asked He Dongshan rhetorically. Then he continued, "The target for the first phase was to return to the situation of the 1980s, when domestic demand made up half of the GDP, and this goal was accomplished. The optimum target, however, was to equal the situation of the United States before the 1970s, when internal consumption was 60% of their GDP, ideal for a large country. After that, the Americans went overboard by relying too much on domestic consumption. They let it go over 70% of the GDP. They had insufficient investments and exports, debt was excessive, and private individuals had no savings. all this leading to big trouble. In many areas, China can be self-sufficient and doesn't need to rely too much on exports to foreign countries. In other words, from now on, China does not have to be overly influenced by the fluctuations of the US dollar. China's domestic demand has so far only been raised from 35% of its GDP to close to 50%. Investment and foreign trade still account for more than 50%, and China is still investing too much in capital construction and real estate. Also, after the world economy recovers, the foreign trade proportion of GDP will still increase slightly. But in general terms, the domestic demand proportion has been significantly readjusted upwards. As people's wages are raised and with good returns on business investments, taxes will also be increased accordingly. China will have successfully eliminated the threat of a domestic economic recession that existed before these policies, and also rectified the most serious structural bias in the economy since the beginning of reforms and openness. And the policies killed two birds with one stone, because with the rise and expansion of new businesses everywhere, the unemployment problem in both urban and rural areas was solved. Number three. During this period, many peasants returned to the cities and, taking advantage of the labour shortage, moved into well-paid jobs. But what did the peasants who stayed behind do? They too were busy taking care of their own property. The third set of policies enhanced peasants' property rights to their farmland. This move had been discussed for years. One of the chief motives behind this policy was to divert the peasants' attention from any grievances and maintain social stability in a time of economic crisis. And, as expected, the peasants all got busy taking care of their private property. What about privatization? Little C asked with accusation in her voice. He Dongshen himself was not exactly certain whether or not the farmland should have been privatized. The privatization experiences of other countries had not been completely positive, but he could not change anybody else's opinion on the matter. One thing was certain, and it left him without an argument. The peasants fully supported the privatization policy. After this, China can never go back again, he said rather wistfully. Number four. This was a period of great enthusiasm throughout the country. It looked like it was pretty chaotic, but it was a necessary and constructive chaos. What this chaos meant, though, was that having liberated the nation's forces of production and activated people's economic enthusiasm, the leadership's next most important task was to guard rigorously against fraud and the sabotage of government policies by corrupt officials. The severe and rapid crackdown of 3 weeks earlier had first neutralized the power of many criminal elements, including gangsters, hooligans, human traffickers, and gangs of pickpockets and beggars. While the memory of the early crackdown was still fresh, three new targets were announced: crackdowns on graft and corruption, on manufacturing fake products, and on spreading misinformation. This announcement put the fear of death into everybody. The Communist Party is most proficient at swatting flies. Rounding up a few usual suspects and summarily executing them does a lot to intimidate the local officials. It makes them pull their socks up no end and thus achieves the desired goal. As long as the local administrations improve somewhat, officials will not dare conspire to defraud the government. With that, the first three sets of new economic policies had comparatively better odds for success. Number five. He Dongshen was in favour of a market economy, but he didn't believe the market was infallible, and he certainly didn't believe in laissez-faire economics. He knew that at certain points the government had to step in. The above four sets of policies created real aggregate demand and stimulated a corresponding level of production to meet it. There was a great increase in the circulation of money and in the amount of credit available in the market, and there were temporary shortfalls in some commodities and services. Even if there was no wild speculation, simply letting the market regulate itself was bound to give rise to inflation. Commodity prices would experience irregular upward swings, and if this developed into hyperinflation, it would put enormous pressure on this stage of economic reform, perhaps even bringing it to a halt. What was to be done? The government had to implement price controls. I believe that this was the most controversial aspect of the prosperity amid crisis plan, said He Dongshan. It was also the policy that required the greatest amount of technical expertise to implement. Those scholars who'd been brainwashed by Western economic ideas would probably have a negative conditioned reflex when they heard the dreaded words price control. He Dongshan was self-taught in economics, and he had originally had the same reaction to the idea of price control. It was not until recent years, after he'd immersed himself in the study of Western economic history, that he discovered that in the last century, developed Western countries had, on several occasions, successfully implemented large-scale price control policies. And these were all capitalist countries. His eyes were certainly opened when he read how Walter Rathenau had successfully managed the economic plan of the German Empire during the First World War period. During the Second World War, the Third Reich had also successfully combined aspects of capitalism and a planned economy. Most encouraging, said He Dongshan, were President Franklin Roosevelt's Second World War economic policies, including price controls, that not only supported an enormous military expenditure, but also allowed the United States to free itself from the Great Depression that had bedeviled the nation for 12 years. The economist John Kenneth Galbraith served at the time as deputy head of the Office of Price Administration with a staff of some 16,000 employees. Before becoming president of the American Economic Association in 1972, Galbraith wrote a book on price control policies. And in the 1970s, during a period of economic stagflation, he again advocated them. All Western economists are not, then, opposed to price control policies. It is just that in the last 40 years, the ideas of the Chicago School of Market Fundamentalists had so much influence that no one remembered that price control is a good strategy for regulating a market economy. In France, right up to the 1980s, 40% of economic activity was still regulated by price controls. This was the breakthrough He Dongshan had made in his understanding of economics. After that, he combined his new knowledge with China's actual circumstances and tried to sell his ideas to his other comrades. Fortunately, many Chinese officials had just emerged from the socialist command economy and were willing, on the surface at least, to accept a market economy. In their heart of hearts, however, they were elated to hear about price control policies. In a period of economic transition, price controls were actually a necessity. They would assist the market and save this newly emerged market from self-destruction, but would not usurp the functions of a mature market economy. None of the officials in He Dongshan's price control group were dyed-in-the-wool ideologues. The core members of the group were technocrats in their 50s who had accumulated the price control experiences of 30 years of reforms and openness. They had recruited a large number of the best students of statistics and econometrics from China's premier universities to set up a database and develop software for a nationwide network of a kind not available in an earlier age of planned economy. This made it possible for producers and consumers throughout the world to go online and locate the most up-to-date price control information. Price controls make real prices transparent. They're intended to allow business people to make money and encourage them to produce, but prevent them from entertaining ideas of speculation, hoarding, and profiteering. What should be regulated, what should not be regulated, and what is the influence on supply and demand? These are the things that have to be handled just right in order to inhibit major fluctuations in prices. Even more necessary is relinquishing control at just the right time to allow the market's own regulatory mechanism to take over. This sort of large-scale regulatory feedback system implemented in China was a startling revelation to the initially skeptical foreign media. To put it bluntly, even a more authoritarian dictatorial government would only be able to implement this command economy for a new age by employing 21st-century automated information and calculation systems. Price controls provided a kind of armed escort to smooth the path of China's latest large-scale economic reform. In the world today, said He Dongshan, his voice beginning to break, China is truly the only country that could accomplish all five of these policy changes at the same time. While the global economy was in great difficulty and Western countries were in a shambles, this was China's opportunity of the century. An originally almost moribund top leadership had in a very short time transformed the social and political crisis caused by an economic meltdown into a golden opportunity. All of which made the rest of the world accept the idea of China's ascendant prosperity. At the Party Congress the following year, the top leadership transition proceeded smoothly. He Dongshen admitted he didn't do as well as he'd hoped. His plan to be promoted to secretary in the Central Party Secretariat came to nothing, and he was merely promoted from an alternate to a full member of the Politburo. He was now a veteran of three leadership changes. On the first anniversary of the Action Plan for Achieving Prosperity Amid Crisis, He Dongshen had wryly congratulated himself. He Dongshen, you did brilliantly. A century-old dream comes true. Fang Chaodi and Little Xi were quite stupefied by this lecture, and they still had many questions they wanted to ask about that week of anarchy, but they were swept along by He Dongshen's monologue. He Dongshen went to the bathroom, came back, drank another glass of water, and carried on speaking even more bombastically. Fang Chaodi and Little Xi didn't deny that in the last 2 years, China's economic situation had been good, but they believed that the political situation had become much worse. China was moving further and further away from constitutional democracy. They complained that everyone seemed to be satisfied with the status quo.
Everyone seems to be perennially happy, said Little Xi.
Then old Chen spoke up. I was one of those people, he said. Before meeting Little Xi again, he'd thought that China's present society was perfectly harmonious. Every day, he was moved by his own sense of happiness. It was old Chen's turn to hold forth now. Not long ago, he thought that Taiwan and Hong Kong were leading and that mainland China was trailing behind. But now he felt quite the opposite was the case. Everyone used to criticize the mainland for being poor and backward, but then suddenly they started loudly proclaiming that China's golden age of ascendancy had arrived. For so many years, intellectuals had said that the Western system was superior, and the whole world looked up to the United States, Japan, and Western Europe. But then in unison, they suddenly changed their tune, and now the whole world was learning from or emulating China. He Dongshen interrupted and resumed his speech. He was still tied to his chair. His captors had no intention of unleashing him.
Of course, there are some elements of misconception here that cannot withstand an empirical item-by-item consideration, he said. For example, China's per capita income is very far behind that of developed countries, environmental degradation is rampant, honest government is not to be found, human rights are not guaranteed, and freedom of speech is restricted.
China has so many people, though, that its overall strength is always astonishing, and its rise is an incontestable fact. The Chinese media frequently report that in this area, China is number one in the world, and in that area, China is in the first rank. Not being completely clear about all that, the average Chinese person these days believes that China leads the world in everything. In the past, foreign manufacturers had complained that China kept the value of its renminbi artificially low in order to subsidize Chinese exports, and that this created unfair competition. Western labor organizations also criticized China for exploiting its workers to maintain the preferential cost of its exports, thus lowering the living standards of workers all over the world. Now that China no longer relies on depressing export prices, the renminbi can appreciate in value. Chinese people can buy more imported goods and go abroad as tourists or even purchase foreign businesses. Incomes have risen across the board. Companies are making good profits and the state's tax revenue has gone up accordingly. With this extra revenue, education, health insurance and social security can all be improved, and China can redouble its efforts to combat environmental degradation.
If we cannot protect our workers, said He Dongshen, and cannot provide universal health insurance and social security, then what kind of a socialist country would we be?
For the first time, Little Xi and Fang Chaodi nodded in agreement.
Not relying excessively on exports doesn't mean not trading with other countries. China is certainly not closed to foreign contact. It's still in the process of developing its heavy industry, and so it's been necessary to buy entire production lines from developed countries such as Germany, transport them to China, and reassemble them here. Furthermore, the United States also has products that China is still unable to manufacture, like Boeing aircraft and high-tech precision instruments. China will buy as many of these as possible. At present, Europe and America still have to rely on Chinese goods. But as China exports less to these countries, it serves to reduce their trade deficit with China. In general, though, China is already able to manufacture most of the goods it needs. Whether some of these are inferior copies or not, China's domestic market is big enough and competition will produce articles of acceptable quality at appropriate prices. Then, the number of industrial products that developed countries can sell to China will gradually decrease. China's internal market is such a juicy plum that foreign capital, big-name brands and retail companies have willingly accepted harsh joint venture conditions for the right to enter or remain in China. China's strict policies violate the spirit of WTO regulations, but since the protectionist and mercantilist activities of the developed nations themselves brought WTO negotiations to a standstill, the idea of global trade without barriers has turned into a pipe dream, and nobody can any longer occupy the moral high ground and lecture China. Our greatest needs are energy, minerals, other raw materials and food, and most of these come from the countries of Asia, Africa and Latin America. Now even Canada, Australia, New Zealand and Russia are both buying Chinese goods and supplying China with these essentials. Basically, China can regard them as third world countries. It has already reached mutually beneficial currency exchange arrangements with the major trading nations, and the renminbi is now a globally circulating currency on a par with the dollar and the euro. China is already as important an economic entity as the United States, the European Union, and Japan. Its inflation remains at an acceptable level of 7 or 8%, and economic growth has topped 15% 3 years running. Such growth was seen before, during the 30 years of reforms and openness. From 1982 to 1984, China's GDP rose 15% a year, but the total size of the GDP was small. To put it simply, China is now the only locomotive powering global economic growth. No wonder the nations of Asia, Africa, and Latin America want to be close to China, and no wonder people now say that the age of American imperialism is over and the Chinese century has begun. He Dongshan paused to clear his throat. Old Chen, Little Si, and Fang Chaodi didn't understand economics, but they were concerned about China, and knew, therefore, that they could not ignore the subject. They listened attentively and with narrowed eyes to He Dongshan's explanations. What rendered them truly speechless was when He Dongshan turned from economics to a discussion of the international political situation. No matter how badly off the American economy is, the United States is still militarily the strongest nation in the world. Only the armed forces of the United States have the power to strike anywhere in the world. He Dongshan got back into his stride. China cannot, therefore, follow the path taken by the Soviet Union during the Cold War, competing for world hegemony with the United States, conducting an arms race, implementing a balance of terror policy, of mutually assured destruction. No, that is not the way to pacify the world, and not where China's permanent security interests lie. A rational person like He Dongshan, with his deeply concealed Chinese-style idealism, knew that this road was a dead end because China's national power could not support it. To prevent the United States from starting a long-distance war, China has to employ its long-range preemptive or unilateral strike capabilities. To prevent the invasion of its territory and to safeguard its national interests, China has to become a friendly older brother to its regional neighbours and not compete with the United States for world hegemony. To use the language of international discourse, this is China's Monroe Doctrine. American nuclear weapons could destroy China, so it has to make the US understand clearly that China will not wait for them to strike first, but will itself attack. In other words, The United States cannot viciously threaten China with its nuclear weapons because it might provoke China into using nuclear weapons first. That is the essence of China's preemptive first strike strategy. China has only sufficient first strike nuclear capability to destroy Hawaii and a few cities on the west coast of the United States. But that is enough to inflict unacceptable levels of destruction on the Americans. Even if the U.S. counterattack could then produce 100 times more destruction in China, the American people would still regard the damage on their own soil as too high a price to pay. China employs these two threats, preemptive first strike and long-range unilateral attack, to frighten the Americans out of the idea of launching a nuclear war against it. Even the victor in a nuclear war will pay too great a price. This is also a tacit live and die together agreement. China's strategy is open and made perfectly clear to the United States in order to avoid any misunderstanding on their part. At the same time, China has consistently urged the Americans not to establish an anti-missile defense network in the Eastern Pacific, because that would give rise to a Sino-American nuclear arms race and force China to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of breaking through the American anti-missile shield, as well as build nuclear submarines and space-based weapons. He Dongshan didn't believe that nuclear war between the United States and China was likely, and he believed that the probability of the U.S. launching a conventional warfare invasion of Chinese territory was virtually nil, despite the continued presence of the American military throughout East Asia. Historically, he said, the Chinese nation's greatest fear had always been invasion by non-Chinese ethnic groups, the division of China's national territory, and rule by non-Chinese conquerors. Such fears are quite unnecessary now. China's current national defense systems are the strongest they have ever been in the 5,000-year history of the Chinese race. Who would dare invade the Chinese territory today? He asked emphatically. Since the founding of the People's Republic, leaving aside conflicts involving Taiwan, Tibet and Xinjiang, China has had short-term military clashes on its borders with India, the Soviet Union, the former South Vietnam and Vietnam. The only conflict that truly threatened Chinese national security was the resist the United States, assist North Korea conflict of 60 years ago. There are 14 nations with which China has land borders, and six with adjacent territorial waters. Since 1949, China's already settled 14 land border disputes and 3 offshore island disputes, but there are still some disputes that cannot be settled in the immediate future. These include India's refusal to recognize Chinese ownership of the 38,000 square kilometer Aksai Chin region on the Tibetan Plateau, China's refusal to recognize the 84,000 square kilometer South Tibet region as part of the Arunachal Pradesh province of northeast India, bordering on Tibet and Bhutan. Disputes in the South China Sea between China and each of Vietnam, Singapore, Malaysia, the Philippines and Brunei. Sino-Japanese disputes in the East China Sea, and even with the small Himalayan nation of Bhutan. Furthermore, Chinese plans to build large dams in Tibet and Yunnan to change the river courses there are coming under increasing criticism, and have given rise to heated disputes over transnational water sources because, except for the Ganges, the headwaters of all the major rivers that flow into the countries of South and Southeast Asia are in China's Himalayan region. Still, none of these disputes, or even occasional armed clashes, are very likely to develop into full-scale warfare between China and some other country. He Dongshan knew, of course, that there were elements in the military that didn't like his views, because of possible effects on their budgets. Although he didn't agree with the tireless calls by these military interest groups for the government to increase spending on the armed forces, he was not so naive as to imagine that a large nation could rise without the support of military power. He was a realist, and he only wanted to optimize the national interest most effectively without depending on the military to achieve the victory. To do this, it was necessary to consider grand strategy. He believed that if a country claims the moral high ground too much, it will make other countries suspicious. In the past, when China was always proclaiming that it would never seek hegemony and talking about its peaceful rise and a harmonious world order, did other countries believe it? This is a time when other nations worry about China, and so it is a good idea for China to make its national strategic interests perfectly clear so that others will know where to draw the line. That is why China recently put forth the idea of a Chinese Monroe Doctrine. In the 1820s, President Monroe announced that the rising United States didn't intend to contend for hegemony with the great powers of Europe, but that they must not invade any part of the American continent. They especially must not try to colonize parts of Latin America again. The Americas were for the Americans. That was the Monroe Doctrine. Now China has emulated the 19th century United States and announced that it has absolutely no intention of contending with other great powers for global hegemony. But East Asia is for the East Asians, and China has invited the Euro-American great powers, primarily the United States, to leave East Asia. What China means by East Asia also includes Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia, Japan, and all of the nations that were historically part of the Chinese tributary system. During the long period of history when a steppe civilization of northern and western Asia was continually colliding and mixing with a European civilization derived from the Mediterranean area, China was shielded behind the Gobi Desert and high mountain ranges. The self-sufficient Chinese autarchy considered itself a tianxia, or all under heaven, a world unto itself with a high level of cultural unity. Perhaps due to geographical reasons, the ancient Chinese Empire didn't have as great a penchant for foreign invasion and expansion as so many other nations over the centuries. Alexander, the Romans, Attila, the Crusaders, the Mongols, Timur, the Ottomans, Napoleon, all the European powers and Japan during the age of exploration and colonization, or the post-Cold War United States of today, with its 850 military bases located all over the world. China, He Dongshen said with force and getting hoarse now, certainly does not want to take on the arduous and thankless task of policing the world, nor does it want to govern other countries. Have you ever heard of the People's Republic of China trying to occupy other people's territory? According to his understanding, the Chinese century is not a century to be enjoyed by China only. The Chinese century means that China has finally regained the rightful historical position that it occupied before the 19th century. The European powers and the United States have to understand China's intentions. It does not want to take over the world. But Europe and the US should not imagine that they can prevent the rise and optimal development of East Asia under Chinese direction. If only the United States would leave East Asia, China, the US, and Europe could maintain their own spheres of influence without mutual interference, and they could all prosper. Replacing a struggle for global hegemony with the regionalization of political influence would guarantee world peace during this period of the unstoppable rise of China. In the economic realm beyond politics, the world is already divided into three regions: the European Union, the North American Free Trade countries, and the Asia-Pacific region. The total internal trade and direct investment within each region is greater than the economic activity between the regions. The European nations' chief trading partners are other European Union nations, and Canada's is the United States, not Japan or China. Starting in 2007, over half of the trade of Asian countries, excluding the Middle East, but also adding in Australia and New Zealand, has been with other Asian nations. All that remains is to link politics and economics together on the same footing, and you will have regionalization. Then Europe, America and China can do business within their own territories and spheres of influence, and can both cooperate and compete on investments and developments in Africa, Asia and Latin America, based always on economic criteria. In Angola, for example, China, France and the United States can all seek offshore oil drilling rights, and the local government will have more choices and not be easily controlled by any one country. The Second Iraq War convinced China to invest heavily in Africa. Angola is now China's largest single supplier of oil. Other African nations that supply us with fossil fuels include Sudan, the Republic of the Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Nigeria, Chad, Mauritania, Mali, Niger, Benin and Gabon, while Algeria provides natural gas. Over 30% of our petroleum imports come from Africa, second only to the supply from the Middle East. Besides energy, China is also active in mining and forestry in Africa. Large areas of farmland are under contract to meet Chinese demands. China has also built roads, hospitals, harbours, airports and communication networks. China has always advocated trade, friendship and non-interference in other nations' internal politics, and African leaders welcome this attitude. It's not surprising that our power and influence in Africa will soon surpass that of America, France and Great Britain to become Africa's number one trading partner. In South Asia and the Middle East, China has friendly relations with Iran and has expended a great deal of thought and money on its long-term friend, Pakistan. This is an important strategic national security consideration. To contain America's ally, India, our so-called Cold to India, Warm to Islam policy, and to protect our oil supply lines, the shortest route for the shipment of African and Middle Eastern oil is by sea or overland to the port of Gwadar in southwest Pakistan, and then north along the Chinese-built Gwadar-Dalbandin Railway to meet up with the Karakoram Highway in China's Xinjiang province. This avoids a long sea journey from Africa or the Middle East and bypasses the Indian Ocean and South China Sea shipping lanes, especially the narrow and busy Straits of Malacca, where the navies of India, the US, Singapore, Thailand, Indonesia, the Philippines, Australia and Japan frequently conduct joint naval exercises. China has also not failed to grab any energy resources that have slipped out of the grasp of other great powers. In 2008, when the price of oil fell from $147 to $33 a barrel, China greatly increased its oil imports from Venezuela and Iran. In 2009, when Russia reneged on its contract and stopped importing natural gas from Turkmenistan, China reached out its helping hand and signed a 30-year contract with Turkmenistan that included building a gas pipeline across Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan all the way to China. The same goes for oil from Kazakhstan. China not only participated in its extraction, but built 3,000 kilometers of oil pipelines. With the exception of Russia and Iran, the nations in the region are all landlocked, and their energy exports have to be shipped through other countries. Therefore, they all support China's ultimate strategic goal in Central Asia, that is, the construction of a pan-Eurasian energy bridge, an oil pipeline from the Middle East through Iran, Russia, Azerbaijan, and Kazakhstan to Xinjiang. Today, in its own national interest, China wants to promote regional stability in Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, Iran, and Pakistan. It wants to prevent any manipulation by other great powers and to block the influence of religious extremists, separatists, and terrorists who want to undermine or overthrow the governments in those regions. In order to isolate the Xinjiang independent forces, China has offered special friendship to the six stans of Central Asia and to Turkey. Turkey has long been denied entry into the European Union, but China has offered it observer status in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and has given Iran official membership. Most unexpectedly, even Israel has to be friendly towards China, because Israel is afraid that China will export high-tech weaponry, including nuclear weapons, to Islamic countries. It is selling sophisticated technology to China. China also did not oppose Russian efforts to counteract American influence in the continental heartland regions of Central Asia, the Caucasus, and the Ukraine. These multi-ethnic nations didn't, however, want to throw themselves back into the Russian embrace. Kazakhstan, for example, has not forgotten the great suffering they endured as a result of Stalin's forced removal policies and on the Soviet collective farms. Uzbekistan was even casting amorous glances towards the US and NATO. All of the Central Asian nations agreed that China had no political ambitions in the region, and so they felt more confident in doing business with China. On the contrary, it was China that didn't want Russia to get the idea that they were trying to muscle in on Russia's sphere of influence. The new foreign policy term for the Chinese and Russian governments was coordinated diplomacy, and that explains why the Chinese provided a huge loan to the small nation of Moldova to the west of the Black Sea, with which China had never had any affiliation.
It was to collaborate with the Russians in their effort to prevent Western power from moving east.
Thank you. Jetzt gibt es Freiheit statt Mutter. Mein Luxus mit Freiheit ohne Futter. Ich will im Kien-Paradies drin. Die Welt soll bloß nicht so mies sein. Ich will bloß Wahrheit, Brot und Tomaten. Prosen für Liebe und ein Sojabraten. Oi, oi, Mama, Hoffnung, die ich heg. Mütterchen, mein Russland, mach dich auf den Weg. Oi, oi, Mama, blas mal in den Glut. Feuerchen, du wärmst mich und das macht mir Mut. Michael, Michael. Michael, Michael. Schnuppe, ich denke, dass ich dir damit nicht kränke. An deine Taten soll man dir messen. Freiheit und Lieder und Wurst zum Essen. Oi, oi, Mama, der alles kann. Macht, macht dumm, schnell wird man ein Tyrann. Oi, oi, Papa, du kannst mehr. Bleibe immer Mensch und sei ein Revolutionär. Michael, Michael. Oi, 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 Michael, Michael. Michael, Michael. Generäle und Offiziere, Orden behängte hohe Tiere. So viele Menschenverwalter, die sehen Glasnost mit kalter, mit kalter Wut, mit heißem Schrecken. Schrecken musst du wieder in der Arbeit stecken. Oi, oi, Mama, eine neue Zeit, offen alle Grenzen, oi, Gerechtigkeit. Oi, oi, Kinder, klein ist unsere Welt und sie soll ein Kartel werden, grün und gut bestellt.